That's a Ben Shawn over there. That's a Larry Rivers. And this is a Rauschenberg.
The works of art on the walls of George Plimpton's New York apartment were at one time all covers of the literary quarterly The Paris Review, the small journal Plimpton and his friends founded 50 years ago in Paris. That the Review has managed to reach the celebrated age of 50 is a grand achievement, since most literary journals are the mayflies of the publishing world. Plimpton's apartment overlooks the East River in Manhattan. It's a book lover's paradise, with rows and rows of shelves crammed with crumbling tomes. It's also a place for fun. There's a billiards table and a piano where he entertained staff during New York's recent blackout. No 50th anniversary would be complete without an anniversary book, and one is out, a collection. Plimpton reads the windy title.
Yeah, here we are. It says the Paris Review book, which is in very small letters, of heartbreak, madness, sex, love, betrayal, outsiders, intoxication, war, whimsy, horrors, God, death, dinner, baseball, travels, the art of writing, and everything else in the world since 1953.
We asked him to sit back and tell us about the founding of the Review with his friends, writers Peter Matheson and Harold Humes, young men of means and education.
And they had a very simple idea. It was to concentrate almost entirely on what is loosely called creative work, short stories and poetry, and eschew, if I can use that word, criticism and reviews. It's a funny name for a magazine, the Paris Review, because it doesn't exist in Paris anymore. It doesn't publish reviews. The one nod to critical work was that we would go and see novelist A rather than critic B. And rather than getting critic B to write about novelist A in a review or a criticism, we would go to novelist A and get him or her to talk about the craft of writing. And in my college at Cambridge, King's College, there was E.M. Forster, considered at the time, I suppose, the greatest living novelist. And so I went to it. And of course, the relationship between Don and a student at Cambridge is very easy. I mean, I would refer to him as Morgan, which was his middle name. Everybody called him Morgan. And he said he'd be delighted to be interviewed. And so his is the first interview in the Paris Review. It's a fascinating interview. He talks about why he stopped writing novels in 1924.
Now, most people would know his novels as Passage to India.
Passage to India.
The Longest Journey, Room with a View. Yeah. Why had he stopped writing novels?
Well, he began describing a novel he'd started called Arctic Summer. And the focal point of the novel was a train station in London. I think it was King's Cross, although I've forgotten. And his idea was that he would put these passengers, these people, his characters, onto trains, and then they would come back to the station, apparently, something like that. Anyway, he put these, as he told us rather sorrowfully, he put his characters onto these trains, and they never came back.
Was it so common, then, to interview writers at length as it is now?
Well, these interviews were done back in 1953. People didn't do interviews then.
Exactly.
You know, there were no tape recorders. We always had two interviewers, one with a pencil and a pad, and the other asking the questions. And then if the pencil broke, everything had to stop. And so it was rather novel, not only for the interviewers, but for the interviewees. Also, I think that writers are rather interested in talking about their craft. No one had ever asked them about it before. And I think some of them had the feeling that, for example, Hemingway, I think the reason he gave his interview, really, was because he started that way in small literary magazines.
When you sat down with Hemingway, how soon was that after you had founded the Review? And where did you do the interview?
It was in Paris. He was on his way to Africa. He'd been shooting skeet off the stern of the France ocean liner, I think it was. And a friend of mine shot skeet with him, or clay pigeons, whatever it was, and introduced me to him in the bar of the Ritz Hotel, a favorite bar of his.
Is he still living in Paris?
He actually bought a copy of the Paris Review in a bookstall right there in the Ritz Hotel. I saw him buying it. The only time I've ever seen anybody buy a copy of the Paris Review was Hemingway.
When you think back to the people who have written for the Paris Review, who have done some of these interviews for you, what are some of the stories, you know, writers like yourself have such good stories? I mean, about trying to obtain an interview, was anyone particularly difficult or...
You mean in the interviews?
Yeah.
Well, I think some of the interviewees did not particularly like to talk about writing. I mean, Hemingway did not like to talk about writing. It made him uneasy, I think. He had some idea that somehow to talk about it, it emptied the well. He was always using that as a sort of a symbol. And I remember asking him, I had a terrible experience with him. I asked him about the high incidence of birds when characters in his books were making love. And he got very angry, and he said, "So you think you can do better?" And I had a terrible time. I mean, I thought he was going to slug me. He did not like to talk about it. One of the reasons may be that when you do write in symbols of that sort, even though they're disguised and should be, and all of a sudden some young punk says, "What about these birds of yours?" You know, the symbol has shone through, and it isn't any good. And it's a sort of a secret betrayed.
Mm-hmm. When you could never have envisioned that you would be doing this 50 years later, did you? I mean, what was your sense of the longevity of this? Did you think, we'll do this for 5 years, we'll do this for a few years?
The literary magazines do tend to have very short lives. They're like butterflies. And there were moments when the magazine almost died. I mean, literally had just flutters of life.
What was one of the low moments?
Well, one of them, when I came back, I finally had to make a living myself, so I came back and began to teach at Barnard. The first monies came from, I think, my father, $500. Peter's father, $500. Anyway, it was enough to print the first magazine. And then we had to look around for money, because it was fast running out. And then my old friend from Harvard, actually, Sadruddin Aga Khan, we were down in Pamplona, and it was during the running of the bulls down there, running before the bulls, that I asked him if he could become publisher of the Paris Review. And he was the son of the Aga Khan. And
you mean you actually had this discussion as you were thundering down the cobblestone
streets? I'm sorry, I sort of skipped time. We were running before the bulls, and it was a good time to ask him for anything, because his mind was not on, whatever I was asking him to do. It was the bulls were right behind him. And he said, yes, I will, I'll do that. And he became the publisher for 23 years. And then he stopped, and we began to have a lot of troubles. And there was a fellow down the way in this block of apartments who was the manager of Barry Manilow and wrote songs. One of the songs was called Sugar, Sugar.
I think we all remember it.
Yeah. The Archies. And he sang all the parts in The Archies.
The Bubblegum School.
All the way from soprano down to basso profundo were all one person. Mm-hmm. His name was Ron Dante. Wonderful person. He came down to see us one day, and we all looked glum. We had no money. And he said, can I help you? And I said, yes, you can become the publisher. He wasn't a literary man at all, but he was the publisher for 7 years. It didn't cost very much, you know, to do it, but there were always people that came when we really were in trouble.
And you've never taken any profit from it yourself?
No.
You've never gotten paid at all?
No. In fact, I paid out. But it didn't make any difference. I've often joked with Peter Matheson, who got me involved, about what has he done with... How could he have done this, you know? This terrible thing. Flung this man into this impossible position. But I haven't regretted one bit of it.
Paris Review founder George Plimpton. The review still gets 20,000 submissions a year, overseen by young editors who work in a warren of rooms downstairs from Plimpton. It's they who chose the material for the new anthology. For more on the Paris Review, see our website at npr.org.